You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our episode with Neil Golder, there was a technical glitch, and so we missed the first 2.5 minutes. And so that's the introductory part and the lead into the song Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. So we will start with that song and then continue with the interview. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. I'm your host, Eric Clay, and our guest on this hour is Neil Golder. So, Neil, to live the life you value now and to do the work that you do around conversation and as a form of love, what did you have to go through to kind of come to that realization that this is how you, what you need, one of the things you need to be doing now?
Well, I suppose I had to go through my whole life.
Yeah. But what were things that you feel helped you move along?
Yeah. Well, when I was thinking about the show, about how significant growing up in the 60s was, with the Vietnam War, with you know, drugs, sex, and rock and roll. Uh-huh. You know, so that was pretty formative. But anybody looks at anybody's. I have a lot of formative events.
But what's people? What were the light bulb? What were some of the light bulb moments, or the at peace or the at one-ment kind of moments that kind of helped you to integrate?
Well, I don't know if I wouldn't say they were at peace or at one-ment moments, because I think probably the most significant thing in my life so far was the death of my wife, Kathy. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't peaceful. It wasn't at one-ment. And I'll always be dealing with it in some form mm-hmm. or another. Mm-hmm. And Kathy and I had a lot of conversations. That's how we started our relationship.
Right.
But and then another one is when I got run over by a car in College Town in 2003. And that was, I was rolled under the car and crushed and mm-hmm. broke my pelvis and everything. And, oh, I can't believe I have my phone here.
It happens. Yeah. We understand.
Yeah. And so that was very interesting in many ways, because it was the... From that moment, I think my heart opened because I was so totally taken care of. You know, the fire department came and jacked up the car, and the ambulance came, and the helicopter came. There's all the medical people came, and you know, and they were all doing it for me, you know, to save my life. And even when I was recuperating, the community came and helped. I didn't have to go into a recuperative place. I recuperated at home. And a lot of people from the Catholic Worker and from all different parts of the community, people who knew me, mm-hmm. people who didn't know me, came and helped. And it was incredible. You know, so there was, so as I call that a heart opening moment.
Right, right. The outpouring of attention and regard helped. What opened your heart? I mean, I'm making an assumption here. What actually, how did you notice that your heart had opened?
Well, it was interesting because I felt more empathy for the people. I noticed an increase in empathy for the people around me. Mm-hmm. Even though they were caring for me, I felt I could see them in a deeper way. I could see their humanity.
Right.
I could see their suffering. I could see their joys.
So in your time of profound physical and, you know, and emotional, spiritual need, you grew in empathy rather than in demands.
Yeah.
And for some
I'm
people,
sure I had demands.
Well, no, but I mean, it's both and, it's not either or, but that's a powerful awareness.
Yeah. I mean, I think I could sometimes see that people in caring for me were healing themselves, mm-hmm. you know, which is great. I mean, if we care for each other and heal ourselves at the same time, I mean, what could be better?
Right. And I'm gonna come back to this, the reason I and how I use the word peace. It's a little bit like the way you use love. Love is not about sentimentality. Peace is not mm-hmm. about the absence of conflict.
Uh-huh.
It's the clarity of how to live within it as graciously as uh-huh. one can. And your heart opened. How did it change awareness of empathy, but did it change the way you treated people consciously?
I think that... I don't know if it was from that time on, but I'm much more aware of death, and that we're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to be aware of that, mm-hmm. and that does add meaning and meaning to life and to relationships and to just being in the world, to know that we're going to die, and all our friends and everybody we know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've been touched at a certain point in my life. There were a lot of deaths. My parents, my sister, Peter DeMott, mm-hmm. our beloved Peter DeMott, and my wife. So, That's an awareness that's there,
mm-hmm.
and it's usually something people, including me, want to run away from and forget about. But I think it's probably about the most important thing.
Because you're aware of death, what do you notice in your interactions?
I think I notice the little deaths that happen all the time, the little deaths and the little rebirths that are happening all the time.
Right. The things we lose and the things we gain.
Yeah. Well, like even now talking to you, you know, there's moments when I go off somewhere or I lose connection or I get nervous about people are listening, you know, and this is a kind of death. And then there's also times when there's an increase in some kind of empathy or mystery or something like that.
Yeah. And you're not attached to either one.
Well, I don't know if I would say that.
And by that I mean you're not clinging as you're watching.
Yeah, there's... I was trying to think of this... a fragment of a Mary Oliver poem where she says something like, in order to live this life, you need to love what is mortal, to hold it close to your bones. And when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. And so I don't want to walk around being detached. I want to walk around engaged and committed and loving the world. And
and again, this is how spiritual words cause us to trip sometimes. Mm-hmm. When you observe your life, you note it honestly and you live it with engagement, but you don't try to make one moment the next. Or, you know, you don't try to force a future or force a past. That's when you're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And when you notice how you come in and out of a conversation, that is what I would call Ignatian spiritual indifference or non-attachment, but not detachment, not a pushing away.
Right,
not a pushing away.
Yeah, you know, this time of life, I'm 72, I've been in Ithaca for 50 years, and this time of life is very much a time for me of review, assessment, digestion. Uh-huh. You know, working with memory. You know, what are all these things, and what you know, what do I let go of? What do I hold on to? What, you know, what did this mean? How did I, you know, all these things.
This is the conversation with yourself.
Yeah. Well, you can have that with other people too.
No, but I mean, it's both. Yeah. So, what is it? What are you learning about your life, or about yourself, or about others, as it becomes more a focal point?
Yeah, the learning is, you know, I'm having trouble with the word learning.
Yes,
because learning has a little intellectual aspect, which I don't think there is an intellectual aspect to this,
and I don't mean it that way, because when you know something, you know it intimately, physically, you know it emotionally, and you know it intellectually. If you know it, it has to work on all three levels, and they conspire to spirituality, in my less than humble opinion. So I didn't mean intellectual.
So, you know, Mary, I go to Mary Oliver a lot, and she says something like, there's only one question: how to love this world. And if I am learning anything, it's learning how to love this world. Then comes the question of how to love this world and how to know this world, how to know oneself, how to know other people.
And more.
And acting in the world also.
Right. Yeah. But I want to, and this is where I want to come to that Mary Oliver question, but I want to kind of spend some time with what you mean by love. It's not sentimentality.
Right. For me, it's giving and receiving, being open, being open to the mystery of our lives and the world. That's a little summary.
Mm-hmm. But when you encounter somebody who is enraged with openness, it tends to disarm them.
Uh-huh.
If you don't become in the least defensive or controlled by their uh-huh. anger or their rage. We, at this point in our political life, need that kind of openness,
mm-hmm.
that love, yeah. so that we can not so much absorb, but observe mm-hmm. each other with kindness.
Yeah, I've recently gotten interested in nonviolent communication, and I haven't done much with it yet, but that's kind of mm-hmm. my next interest. And what struck me is that we can learn empathy. And I never, I never thought of it, but somehow that strikes me as quite incredible when you think that you can actually learn empathy through practicing.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. I grew up in a small town. There were lots of conflicts that simmered over generations, and mm-hmm. and the people who navigated them well were the ones who learned to learn empathy.
Mm-hmm.
The most mature of them could say, even your bitterest enemy needs what it takes to thrive.
Mm.
Never withhold what it takes to thrive.
Mm.
From anybody.
Yeah. There's something about presence, too.
Mm-hmm.
Being present. I mean, people always talk about being in the present. I don't mean that. I mean being present to what's happening, which is easy to say, but not necessarily easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's a...
And it's not showing up. It's much more than showing up.
Yeah.
So what do you mean? Yeah.
Well, I'll try to give you an illustration. In the play, in the Thornton Wilder play, Our Town, in the last act, the people have died, and the young woman who has died in childbirth, and she wants to go back because she loves the world so much, and she wants to go back and experience it again, and the other people say, no, it's not a good idea. But anyway, she does go back. And, of course, they can't see her. She goes back to her, I think it's her 16th birthday. And she's, and you know, and it's like a morning scene, and the mother is busy getting the child, getting her off to school and everything. And she's, and they can't hear her. And she's saying to her mother, it goes by so fast. It goes by so fast. Can't you just stop and, you know, listen to me or look at me or... Anyway, and she can't stand it, and so she goes back to being dead and to mm-hmm. be doing what she does. So it does go by so fast, and it's really easy. Certainly, I've observed in my life to let it go by and not notice it, and mm-hmm. live in a trance. And maybe the more we talk about this, the more we remind each other that there's something else.
And yes. I want to come back to this, but I want to take a musical break.
I don't know how you're going to remember.
It goes by so fast.
Yeah.
And presence. Those are the key words.
Okay.
What would you like for us to play musically now? Or poetically?
Let's do a little, this Bach piece is pretty upbeat and deep. It's the Bach Italian Concerto.
Hang on a second here. I moved things around a little bit faster than I intended to. For some reason, it is not showing up on my...
Okay.
Can you? Oh, so no.
You want to
I got the Bizet, the Chopin, and the Italian.
Oh, Italian concerto. Is that what I said?
Okay, yeah. I'm exposing my ignorance. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Neil Golder. So Neil, you quoted, "It goes by so fast," and wanting the quality of presence to do what with that fact? It's not going to make it go any slower. Our awareness may change. What is our presence? How does our presence affect it going by so fast?
I don't know how to answer that. Can you put it in another way?
I grew up in an environment where half of the population was over the age of 65. It was a rural exodus. You know, young people would just leave in droves to go to find work and lives elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And they sang that song, "It Goes By So Fast." Mm-hmm. And it was a mourning, and it was a loss. And for those who were highly skillful, they could dance with you. They could meet you when you deliver. I delivered their groceries in their homes because they couldn't get out or whatever. And we would have this brief encounter, and it would feel full and whole, but it was still a brief encounter. It goes by fast. Yeah, and we were present to each other,
mm-hmm.
and taught things to each other and observed, mm-hmm. beheld, which is a word I use frequently in this show. Mm-hmm. We beheld each other,
mm-hmm.
Even as we were moving and doing our required tasks.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the most important moments are in a store when you're at the cashier.
Yeah, yes.
You know, I think there's an opportunity for some kind of connection. It doesn't always happen,
right,
and you
right.
can't and you can't force it. But when it does, it's really good and it's really important. And so I want to be open to that. I don't want to always be having things on my mind. The next, I mean, it's inevitable. You know, I'm human. I'm going to have that. But you know, what's the next thing I have to do? What's the next thing I have to do? And people are just the means to get me what I want.
Right.
You know, that's you know, I walk around like that a lot. Like I assume most people.
Right.
But so if there's an opportunity that presents itself, or that you know, or from. Does my inner state allow the opportunity mm-hmm. to present itself, to make some kind of a connection with somebody,
right.
or not with the person, you know, with a tree, with a dog, with an animal, mm-hmm. with the, you know, with the moon, you know?
Yeah. And you raise a really important issue that we often don't think about, that internal narrative about what do I need to do now? What would be, you know, what's important for mm-hmm. me to attend to next? We can begin to shift it by wanting less, because many of us could want less and still be fully satisfied in life. We can also shift it by focusing on how do I trust that what I need will be present when I'm there.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. And what I'm thinking about is, I don't know if it's related, but this whole idea of this whole experience of having a self-image,
mm-hmm.
you know, having, presenting one's self. I present myself in a certain way to my friends, to my dog, to the public who's listening to this show, and this self-image, I can be caught in it. You know, you're interviewing. I'm the interviewee. Whatever. There's, you know, I'm a man. I'm, you know, Jewish background. I've been an activist. You know, all these things that mm-hmm. go into this self-image, and I'm going to buy a car. And so I'm thinking, you know, I want a safe car, I want a comfortable car, all those things. But I'm thinking, how am I going to look with this car? You know, is uh-huh. it going to, you know, are we going to like right. look well together? Is it going to be appropriate? So this goes back to your first question about who are you? Because I think ultimately two things. One is we don't and can't know who we are, because who we are is we're a part of everything, right? And who we are is all our friends. It's not just, you know, our thoughts and feelings and actions. It's the whole world that we live in and that we see and that we create around us. So in one sense, we can't really know that. In another sense, I believe that we are divine beings, you know, that we are manifestations of the divine. And I wonder if I could do this poem, which is about, it's about identity and about the world and the world of spirit and dream and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes, do.
So I'll just briefly say, this poem came to me mostly when I was out on a walk. And I don't write that many poems, but and it's called Only. And goes like this. Am I the I think I am while I am dreaming? Am I the me I think is me when I'm awake? Who do you think you are anyway? Trying to blow up that leaking Mickey Mouse float that won't inflate. In a dream, The boat that carries me rises, speeds up above the river towards a great city. Is that my mother sitting in front of me? In another, I must find a way to join that flatbed trailer to my car so I can start my long cross-country trip. Now, I'm walking around Beebe Lake. Wild calling geese suddenly above me, others floating still on still water, while these words come. If only I could take the beauty, depth, and hidden meaning of the dream and let it lie upon the world, and take the beauty, depth, and hidden meaning of the world and let it lie upon the dream, and see and be both in love with life, with you, this precious only world. With references to Mary Oliver, mm-hmm. of course. But,
yes.
But yeah, because I often, you know, I attempt to pay a lot of attention to my dreams and to mm-hmm. sleeping and waking. I mean, those are some of the most significant, important, meaningful, strange, mysterious times of falling asleep and waking up. And if we're in the spiritual world when we're asleep, which I believe, what is it that's happening as we're making the transition from waking to sleep and sleep to waking, which I think also has a lot to do with dying. So I don't know if that answers any questions or creates any.
I want to sit in this context, and I'll just talk a little bit. I've because I can be a teacher, I can be a counselor, I can be a landscaper, I can be a construction worker, I'm a landlord, I am all these things, these roles, mm-hmm. and they all have different attire associated with them on some level. So I have spent much of my life, and I've been a minister, and I spent much of my life trying to figure out, you know, how can I respect other people's expectations without completely subordinating myself to them, and to allow the complexity to exist at the same time, which is what the welding of the dream state and the waking state is inviting. This past May, I turned 60, and for my 60th birthday, I got a pair of bib overalls like the old men wore in the town I grew up in, and I walked around for a week in bib overalls, and the reactions were rather strong, mostly uh-huh. positive, but some of them just totally perplexed. When I was in Wegmans, they didn't know if I was delivering stuff or taking it away. It was just kind of funny. Uh-huh. But in my center, I go back to those old men who had this quality of presence, who sat on the street sides and talked with people as they went by because uh-huh. they were no longer working. And that I'm probably going to work until I'm 80 or 90 if I live that long. But that's a quality, a way of being and holding on to the complexity. But I don't always know what I want to put out there. Now, there's an aphorism that's been really important to me, and it's the knowing is telling. The knowing is telling. We had this conversation before that knowing is intimate physical knowledge, emotional knowledge, and mm-hmm. intellectual knowledge. And telling is, it shows, not necessarily by word, mm-hmm. but you reveal it. And when you tell me these stories of your dream images and your waking images, my guess is if I observe you, it's telling 24/7. It shows if I know what to look for, if I am open to you as a human being, there is no barrier, though we experience it as a barrier often, or we want to impose it as a barrier. Mm-hmm. That's what your story inspires me to think about. Uh-huh.
Yeah, obviously we tell or we show with who we are everything, right?
Right.
Our gestures, what we're not even aware of.
We are legion, as the scripture says. There's just so much in us that we can't comprehend.
It's been an interesting, I'll tell you one interesting thing related to that is I had a beard for most of my adult life.
You were a bearded man.
Yes. And in the 60s, the beard went down, you know, halfway down my chest. And at one point, I decided to take off the beard. And sometimes I go by people on the street and they don't recognize me. And sometimes that's good, you know, because maybe I don't want to say hello to them.
right.
And sometimes I have to say, hi, it's Neil. And so, you know, it's this whole thing about, you know, you're talking about your different hat. You know, people expect to see you in a certain way. And there was a young person I was talking to, and she said, I've only known you with a beard, you know. And so it's a little disturbing for people because you're not the familiar person you are. And as you know, when you live in a small town, people have certain expectations or Neil, I know you. Weren't you in the newspaper? You know, you're an activist, and you know all this stuff that people say and people think. And I don't know. I don't know where this is going or what to do with it. But it's interesting, this mush of all these images and images that are put on us.
Right.
Not just,
right.
I think Norman Mailer said something about trying to take off, this idea of self-image, trying to take off the makeup, it would put more makeup on.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You want to be, you know, when people put you in a category, we all have ways of understanding and reading each other, and in part correct and in part off the mark, and that's life. I had to learn that it's better to be hated for the right reasons and loved for the right reasons than to be hated for the wrong reasons or loved for the wrong reasons. And so walking in that, those multiple identities, that became a way of trying to feel the connection. What is the honesty or the truthfulness of this connection? And I can be wrong in that assessment. When did you shave the beard off? Why did you shave the beard off?
Well, I can certainly tell you when. I was in Ireland a couple of years ago, traveling with some friends. And I noticed these wonderful barbershops where, you lie back in the chair and they put, warm washcloths on your face and everything. And I also thought, you know, if I shave the, I must have been thinking about it, you know, wanting a change or something. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, if I do it here, nobody's going to know because they don't know me.
Right,
they're gonna see. You know, they're gonna say, "Well, you shaved your beard." You know, so I did it in Ireland, and then of course, when I came back, I experienced the, oh my God,
yes.
Oh, but so now, I don't want to. I don't keep it shaved. I grow a beard back in the winter. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's you know, try to keep people on their toes and guessing
and to keep yourself nimble.
Yeah.
What has the journey of the death of your beloved brought you in terms of your conversation with the living and the dead?
Well, I certainly could easily say how devastating it was and how she was so much of an anchor for my life and the meaning of my life, and how that was a tremendous, tremendous loss. And I, one way I deal with things is I write. So I wrote a lot, and I still write a lot. I write every day. I do. I can tell you, if there's time, about this practice called morning pages.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Anyway, so and I think she has been teaching me through my dreams to not want her back the way she was. Because I think that's a big thing, is, you know, to want her back, to want us back to the way we were,
right,
is huge. And so in my dreams, she rejects me.
Yep.
So I think what she's telling me is, you know, don't want me back the way I was. Let me be and let me go and who I am now. And, you know, what that is, I don't know. But I
certainly it also means you have to figure out who you are.
Yeah, I didn't really think about that, but yeah. I mean, there's a place where we're together. She and I, you and I, and you know, all of us are together in this
surrounded
in this
by
place.
A cloud of witnesses.
Yeah, yeah. And there's there's like our what do I want to say? Our dead selves are present even in our living selves.
Yes, yes.
So, I suppose the question is how to know that and how to live that, and that's what also I think. We were talking about before, that's what gives a kind of a sadness.
Mm-hmm. It's not sentimentality, but no, it's close, but it is just a profound sadness.
Yeah, yeah.
Longing. With
too deep for tears, as some poet says, you know. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, not to forget the joy. Mm-hmm. That we can experience with all of that.
Yep.
And yeah.
What was the nature of liberation in your relationship with your wife?
The nature of liberation.
Yeah. Because powerful partnerships help us face ourselves and step beyond ourselves. Mm-hmm. They draw out of us things we didn't know we had or didn't know we needed.
Well, I think it goes back to this thing I said about the anchor. You know, when you have an anchor, you can be floating around on the surface without going way off where you don't
right,
want to go.
Right, right.
So there's a certain, I guess I didn't think of the word liberation, but there's a kind of liberation.
Right. Well, in the earlier show today, we had this very conversation about how you need a discipline or a base or a foundation to live your curiosity. Otherwise, you're just reacting. Mm-hmm. You're driven all over the place.
Right.
So there's a quality of conservatism in the best sense of the word that is an anchor that allows you to then go and experience much more than you would, but it doesn't undo you.
Mm-hmm. I think it has to do with a true spiritual connection to the spiritual earth. At the same time as our aspirations for heaven.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. We do a little practice in my class, conversation class, where we stand and do these gestures and I make these sounds. But the basic one is this human one of being vertical. You know, we're the only creatures that are truly vertical, and to be planted in the earth, going down through the earth and going up into the heavens, is is where I want to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what are the sounds and gestures that you use?
You're not going to see the gestures on the radio, but
no. But you can describe them.
The first sound is E, mm-hmm. and the arms are, one arm is straight up, and another arm is straight down. Uh-huh. The next one is Ah, which is a receptive listening where your arms are out like in an A,
uplifted.
And the third is O, where the arms are like making, starting to hug, mm-hmm. you know, which is our community with each other, mm-hmm. with the world.
Our acknowledged community.
Yeah.
Yeah. Neat. Yeah. Neat. So, Neil, we're coming down towards the end of the show, and we will go back to something you mentioned before. What do you do throughout the day on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, yearly, to kind of take care of yourself? Emotionally, physically, intellectually, spiritually, and how do you know you need to do it?
Well, I know I need to do it because if I don't do it, I'll be a little in trouble.
What's trouble?
I'm scattered, worried, not present. So it's so my first practice every day is to write morning pages, which comes from Julia Cameron, The Artist's Way, and it's to write three pages of nonstop writing whatever's on your mind, and right. and everything will come up, you know, things that you're worried about or sad or anything, you're bored, or, right. and aspirations. I think that's also aspirations of what you may want to take a risk right. to do. And I'm actually doing some I'm doing this singing class. It's called the School for Uncovering the Voice. And it's a very, very different approach to singing, where the idea is that the sound comes from the outside into you, even though you're the instrument
right,
of it.
Right.
And that's a very important practice, too. And loving my dog is very, very important. He's 16, and that's taking care of my dog, making sure he gets food and walks, and patting him is absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you learn, or when in your life did you learn that it was your responsibility to take care of yourself? A lot of people, some people don't ever, but when did you learn that that was one of your primary functions, and how did you learn that?
Gee, I'm not sure. I thought I turned it off. Sorry.
That's all right.
I didn't take care of things. It happens more than once. God. Okay. I don't know. Maybe when I went off to college, but even there I was pretty well taken care of, you know, there mm-hmm. was the food and a place to stay, and I suppose camping out is an example of, you know, you have to prepare and make sure you have this and that, and I mean that's more of a mundane answer than
but it's I mean our physical visceral existence is just one dimension of self-care.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, I mean, it was. I think I'm still working on it. You mm-hmm. know, because this whole thing about buying a car, it's like an adult thing. I mean, most cars have been given to me, or I spend a couple $100 or something.
Right. And but you're going out to buy a car.
Yeah, yeah.
You're being intentional.
I have to decide. I have to research. I have to do the finance. You know, it's like buying a house too. But I never bought a house by myself. I bought a house with other people.
Right.
So I don't. You know. But I think what you're trying to get at is taking care of yourself, your inner self.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's what you're talking about.
But it's inseparable from our physical self.
Yeah.
And we often learn it in stages.
Yeah.
What I was wondering when you talked about your wife in your dreams pushing you away.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about it as though she wants an existence free of your relationship, but she may want you to have an existence that is different now for yourself.
Uh-huh.
And when you said, I'm still learning it, that's where I went to in my own, just making connections.
Yeah.
And it may or may not be a connection.
No, I think it is. It's not possible to figure it out.
Oh no! At all. One lives in the presence of the awareness.
Yeah.
And if the awareness yields something productive, then thanks. And if the awareness yields something, doesn't yield anything, you move on to the next awareness.
Yeah.
We are funny critters that way.
Yeah. But this whole thing of the past and memory. You know, there are certain, certain movies that influenced you or books, and
right.
you can still go back to them and get something out of, maybe not the same, but
right.
get something out of them. And then there's certain ones that really meant a lot to you that mean nothing anymore.
Right. You cross that bridge.
Yeah,
you don't have to do it
again.
Like,
and so it's doing that discernment that is, for me, happening more and more. Feel like I have a neck brace on with the headphones.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is not a completely natural conversation.
Right.
There's a lot of technology here that makes it happen. The love that you seek to engage and to share. How do you cultivate that awareness? And this is really the inner question because it's abstract.
Mm-hmm.
It goes away from the skills and the practices.
Yeah. You know, I'm just noticing that sometimes when you ask a question, I go blank.
Yeah.
You know,
yes.
There's like,
it's a deer in the headlight moment.
What is he talking about?
Yep.
And yeah. And which is interesting because what I think is so important is listening, not just to the words, but to the meaning behind the words. And because there's no, so to make a true response, I have to take you in.
Right.
I have to take your words in,
right.
Not just like, oh, what am I going to say to that?
Yeah, or what's my quick reaction?
What does this stimulate? Yeah, yeah. And maybe there is no, maybe it just goes in and it's like, well, I don't know. Of course, that doesn't make a very interesting interview at all.
No, but what the piece on which the show struggles and turns is that simply to be present is to love, to not ignore, pull away, to regard the wholeness of the moment and the other and oneself. And sometimes the question becomes an impediment and we shut down or it takes time.
Yeah.
And I've spent my life asking questions which people didn't necessarily want to answer because either they were hard or I didn't set them up well.
Yeah.
That's just part of our being together.
Yeah. It's an interesting challenge to have an actual conversation where people are equal. Where we're not taking these different roles. I'm sure you've, just in social situations.
Sure.
Sometimes people, they just ask you one question after another. And so there's like a control aspect.
Right.
And so and that's what I work towards with the class at Lifelong is to have a conversation that flows and where something is actually created between the people, between and among, if there's more
right.
than one right. person, rather than, you know, one person is
imposing, yeah. shaping.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a risk in my yeah. role, and it's a risk in your role to yeah. push or control too much. Yeah, yeah, it's yeah. finding the touch.
And ultimately, I think it's necessary and healing for everybody.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Neil, it's wonderful to get to know you. What should we close with today?
Oh, gee. What do we got here? Oh, put on the Robert Frost.
Okay, so we'll play it. We'll play it. We won't have a chance to. Okay, let me find it. I'm having trouble with stuff here.
Okay. Well, you could do Bob Dylan if you
here,
want.
Here, hang on a sec. Okay. For some reason, my. Here you go. We're going to go Dylan for just a minute.
Yeah.
Lay down your weary tune. Lay down the song ye strum. And rest yourself neath the strength of strings. No voice can hope to hum. Struck by the sounds before the sun, I knew the night had gone. The morning breeze like a bugle blew against the drums of dawn.